From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. On February 20th, 1962, astronaut John Glenn, aboard his Friendship 7 spacecraft, was launched from Cape Canaveral's Launch Complex 14 and orbited the Earth three times during a nearly five-hour flight.
Godspeed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5.
The late John Glenn was the last surviving member of a group known as the Mercury 7, who were seven military test pilots selected in 1959 to become America's first astronauts in NASA's budding Mercury spaceflight program. In 1974, 10 years after retiring from NASA's astronaut corps, Mr. Glenn won a seat in the U.S. Senate representing his home state of Ohio. After serving for 24 years, he retired from the Senate at the end of 1998. But a few months before that, in October 1998, John Glenn was back at NASA and returned to space as a member of the crew of STS-95 aboard Space Shuttle Discovery. He was 77 years old at the time, making him the oldest person ever to fly in space. John Glenn, the first American to orbit Earth, died at age 95 on December 8, 2016. On December 25, 2016, Christmas Day, the 20th Century Fox motion picture Hidden Figures premiered in the United States. The movie was based on a true story of three brilliant African-American women who fought racial and gender prejudice in the 1950s and 60s in America to become human computers at NASA during the birth and initial growth of its manned spaceflight program. Back then, to NASA, a computer meant a person, not a machine. The trio of women used their brains to calculate intricate flight trajectories for the early space program. Of the three, Katherine Johnson played a crucial role in the launch and orbital spaceflight of astronaut John Glenn. Electronic computers were still in their infancy at the time, and some of the people at NASA, including Glenn, wanted to make sure that the data it produced was totally accurate. So, John Glenn insisted that Johnson check the computer-generated numbers manually.
Okay, so that puts your landing zone at 5.0667 degrees north, 77.3333 degrees west, which is here. Give or take 20 square miles.
I like your numbers.
Of course, all checked out perfectly, and astronaut Glenn successfully completed his historic orbital mission. With the passing of John Glenn in December and the release of the now-hit motion picture Hidden Figures, this has put a renewed focus on the early history of the space agency's human spaceflight program. So, today, I talk with William Berry, NASA's chief historian, about what it was like back in those early days of putting a human in space. Bill, my first question is, who made this decision of sending Americans into space, and when was it made?
After the Soviet Union launched Sputnik in 1957, the United States had a space program. We were planning on launching a scientific satellite before that. But the Eisenhower administration decided that they needed to do something more dramatic than the scientific programs that were going on. And there were multiple military programs where they were investigating space as well. So the Eisenhower administration decided to create NASA. And one of the first missions for NASA was to see whether you could send a human into space. We were pretty certain that the Soviet Union was going to do that, and we didn't want to be behind on that. And so the Mercury program, early studies on how you could build a space capsule and get someone to space, that actually started at the NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. And most of what became NASA was the NACA in October 1958. Now, other bits and pieces got added as well, but most of it was the NACA. And the NACA staff had been studying that for a while. So it really starts officially in 1958 with Project Mercury.
What guided the decision to make NASA a civilian-led space agency versus a military-led space agency?
There was a lot of debate about that in the spring of 1958 as the discussion was being made about what to do with our space program. The decision was made that there should be a civil space program, in part because the Eisenhower administration had pushed all along that scientific advances should be used for civilian purposes. The nuclear program, for example, was a military program, but there were also civilian aspects where they tried to encourage civilian use of nuclear power for peaceful purposes. Interestingly enough, the same thing happened with space, where the Eisenhower administration wanted to have reconnaissance satellites. We wanted to be able to see what was going on inside the Soviet Union. There was actually a secret program to build reconnaissance satellites, and NASA was going to be the civilian scientific program that would be done in the open. You have the Soviet Union launch not only the first satellite in October 1957, but a month later, they launched a satellite with a dog on board. Clearly, it wasn't just a one-off, and the fact that they launched a living thing into space suggested that they had aspirations to send other living things like human beings into space. Exactly. So
let's get into the Mercury program. When and how was the Mercury program designed?
For the Eisenhower administration, the goal for Mercury was pretty modest. You know, mainly, can we send somebody into space and can they survive? And are there medical and other issues that we need to know about? So it's mainly a question of, can you build a capsule to do it and make the things happen? The physics were pretty clear. It's pretty clear you could probably launch a satellite. The questions were more sort of, how do you control it? Can humans perform effectively in microgravity? Things like that. So the Eisenhower administration put this task to the folks at what becomes NASA. And the human spaceflight program was clearly planted there. Although, interestingly enough, of course, the first astronauts were all military guys. And that was a decision made by President Eisenhower.
One of my favorite movies of all time is The Right Stuff. I remember in the movie, there was a scene where a couple, I guess, NASA advisors were speaking with President Eisenhower, and I think Lyndon Johnson was in the room as well. And they were talking about the people they would select to go into space. And they also suggested people like stuntmen and trapeze artists, people like that, because they were used to the physical exertion. Is that true as well?
Part of that is partially true. It didn't play out the way it's shown in the movie. There's a lot of dramatic license taken there. But initially, when the folks at NASA were starting to look for astronauts, how are we going to get people? They took a pretty wide perspective. I mean, most of the people making these decisions were scientists and engineers who worked on airplanes for a long time. So there's actually an ad written for the Federal Register that was going to be posted that asked for applicants for the astronauts program. And it did ask for people who worked in stressful environments, circus performers, stuntmen, deep sea divers, mountain climbers, this whole panoply of things. But it raised a lot of questions about, okay, well, how much are we going to pay these guys? Will they be able to get life insurance? And what happens if one of them gets killed? Because it was seen to be a risky business.
Right.
And so they wound up going to President Eisenhower during the Christmas break in late 1958. And Eisenhower said, well, you know, we could solve all these problems. You're looking for people who deal well under stress, used to operating high-tech equipment, and you don't want to have to deal with insurance and paying them. Why don't we get military test pilots? So the decision to hire military test pilots was actually driven by the president himself, who said, you know, let's solve this problem and go this way. And the previous idea to look for other alternative and some kind of creative career fields for astronauts, that all went out the window.
We always talk about the Mercury 7. Why seven astronauts?
There's actually a really interesting history behind all that. There were literally several hundred in the first pool, and they narrowed it down and narrowed it down. And they got down to about 13 or so in the crowd. And when they went to make the final selections, the original plan was to do six. But there were a couple of people that were kind of on the bubble, and then the committee that was looking at it finally said, well, these guys are kind of tied, and so let's just include this other guy too. So they wound up with seven. It wasn't a specific plan. They knew they needed at least six. And they didn't want too many more than that because they weren't planning that many flights. So it kind of became seven kind of by accident.
The astronauts had to have a college education, which meant Chuck Yeager, who broke the sound barrier years earlier, wasn't among the people selected.
There was actually a lot of tension between General Yeager and the NASA folks out at what's now the Armstrong Flight Research Center, Edwards Air Force Base. He was one of the greatest stick and rudder guys ever, as pilots say, and was a great pilot and was fearless and did lots of amazing things. But the tension at the time, particularly in the late 1940s when the NACA folks first went out to start flying the X-1, the X-1 was a joint program between the Air Force, the Navy, and the NACA. When they went out to Edwards to do those flight tests, Yeager's job at the time was largely to be the person who flew for the Air Force or the Army Air Force at the time. Mm-hmm. And they were mainly looking at breaking records and pushing the boundaries. The NACA folks were a bunch of engineers, and they wanted to do things slowly and systematically. You know, you don't go Mach 0.8 and then go right to Mach 1.1. You do one flight increments a little bit at a time. And Yeager didn't get that. It wasn't really kind of what his job was anyway. Right? And the NACA guys didn't get Yeager very well either. They thought he was headstrong and not very scientific. And I think they looked down their nose at him a little bit because of the educational differences, because most of these guys were engineers with PhDs and things. And so there's this gap there. So there was a natural tension. So when the astronaut program begins, that gap that was there between those two groups, I think, was, if anything, exacerbated by that. You know, in the book, The Right Stuff, tend to side on the Yeager perspective on things, I think, which is one of the things that I think is a drawback in the book. Not to take anything away from General Yeager. He's, you know, like I said, a heck of a pilot and did amazing things for our country. But I think the book did a disservice to some of the NACA and NASA folks that are depicted in the story.
Back to the selection of the final seven. How many total candidates were considered?
Rick, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but the original number was well over 300 that sort of came into the original pool. And it was all done in secret. The military was asked, okay, we're looking for people who have these certain criteria. And there were educational criteria, as you mentioned, but also they had to be jet pilots at the time. There were a lot of military pilots who hadn't flown jets. There were a lot of propeller-driven airplanes at the time. They were looking for people who had test pilot experience. And you had to be a certain height and weight because the capsule was pretty small, so you had to be under 5'11" and under 180 pounds. And there was pretty tight limits. So one of the reasons why the astronauts all sort of look very similar, they're all kind of the same height because that was the requirement for them to fit into the capsule. They tended to be sort of shorter than average.
I understand that as the astronauts were going through the selection program, they went under a lot of scrutiny, a lot of testing, physically, mentally, psychologically, etc. And some of the tests were pretty brutal. I mean, what was involved and how were the tests developed? What were they looking for?
I'm not sure they knew what they were looking for.
Right.
Is really the answer to the question. I mean, nobody knew what space was going to be like, but they did know they had these test subjects that were going to be going up there, and they wanted to know as much about them as they could before they launched. And much of the physical testing for medical purposes was outsourced to Dr. Randy Lovelace and his team.
In New Mexico?
In New Mexico. And Dr. Lovelace was, if not thorough, and trying to find every possible test that they could do. So they basically subjected the Mercury 7 and the other folks in the screening before them, that there were, many of them were screened out in that process, to every test they could think of. And some of them were pretty brutal, sitting in an ice bath as long as you could, with your feet in the ice, squirting cold water directly into your ear canal to see if it disoriented you. The answer is yes, it does. It doesn't feel very good either. But in the process of doing all those things, they screened out pretty quickly people who had all kinds of minor health problems that hadn't been detected. And you have to remember, these guys are all military pilots. Right. They were required to go to the flight doctor once a year for a medical anyway, so they're in pretty good shape to start with. But nonetheless, they still screened out quite a few of them. And they also sort of tested the commitment level of the folks. How much of this were you willing to put up with to go and fly into space?
Especially since it's pretty much an unknown.
It really was. They really didn't know what to expect, so they did everything. Interestingly enough, if you look at what happened to the Mercury 7, and then you look at the medical testing of the next nine, as they were known, the second astronaut group, there's a dramatic difference in the testing level, because once you flew the first person in space and realized that most of these tests were kind of meaningless
unnecessary,
and the astronauts didn't much like them very much.
I can understand why.
They scaled back the testing on that, and the requirements, and the height and weight requirements, but they actually increased the educational requirements. The next group of astronauts, they were looking for people with advanced degrees, and eventually there were a group that was hired that were scientist astronauts in the early 60s. So
most of the test pilot / astronauts had an engineering background?
By nature of the kind of work they were doing, you didn't have to be an engineer to be a pilot, but the people who went on to be test pilots generally had to have some engineering background. That's, a test pilot's job is basically practical engineering. You're out there doing what the engineers are asking you to do, flying a profile to test, how will this airplane react and these certain circumstances, and you really need to have some understanding of what's going on. In many cases, the test pilots wrote up the reports about what they found, and so you had to have an engineering background to understand what you were doing and be able to explain what was going on. And you also had to be able to write a little bit, too, so that was another requirement that an engineering degree actually helped people with.
Whittling down the candidates down to the final seven and selecting candidates for the space program, did appearance play a role because of PR that was needed?
We don't actually know for sure, because the decisions were made by a small group and their specific reasons for doing things, and their final deliberations weren't recorded for the reason of, you know, not having people second-guess them on those sorts of things. But generally speaking, they were looking for people who would represent the United States as astronauts. And so there was certainly that factor of, you know, you wanted somebody who was reliable, could speak clearly in public, and, you know, at least a little bit outgoing. I suppose they were probably more concerned if there's somebody who's particularly physically unattractive, I suppose that that might distract from things. So the astronauts, all, as it turns out, all tended to be pretty good-looking guys and smart and intelligent. And when you start with a pool of extremely talented people to start with, several hundred people, you can narrow it down, you could find seven really talented people out of that pool.
The reason why I ask that is because one day these gentlemen are test pilots, military people. The next day, instant superheroes to thousands and thousands of people throughout the country.
And there were some very interesting aspects of that as well, because, of course, they were used to living out in the high desert in California or at the Pax River Naval Air Station in Maryland, where the Navy Test Flight School is, or other places around the country. And so kind of normally kind of a remote existence and not in the public eye very much, although a few of them did. Like John Glenn, for example, you know, set cross-country speed record and wound up appearing on What's My Line on TV. And so some of the folks who became astronauts had some experience with dealing with the public. But generally speaking, most of them didn't. And I think they were a bit surprised by it. But they were also people who had been around the military. Most of them were about 10 years in service or more than the 12 years of service. So they'd been around the bureaucracy a bit and they understood where things were. And to some extent, that helped a lot because the public grabbed onto them really quickly. And they realized that once they had that public attention, that they had the ability to influence things within the program more than they might otherwise have. So, for example, the original Mercury capsule didn't have a window. And they said, hey, we're pilots. Airplanes have windows. This capsule's going to have windows so I can see where I'm going. And there were some other things about the program that that got modified because the astronauts had the advantage of being able to go public with their complaints about things and, you know, management of the program.
They were the face of the program, too.
Yeah. So, interesting enough, it didn't happen on the Soviet side.
Speaking of Soviets, the reaction to the flight of Yuri Gagarin, and not only did he go into space, he orbited Earth once. Why did we go with a suborbital flight a month later?
Well, the plan had been to send astronauts on a, you know, a series of flights and build up to the orbital characteristic of flying. And normally that was kind of the progression you'd take with test pilots and things like that. You'd do more and more difficult things. So a suborbital flight seemed to be a logical conclusion to do. The Soviets, for their part, I think might have approached it the same way, except that they realized that the suborbital thing, that the landing part was kind of the tricky part, and they didn't have a handy ocean to land in from their launch site in what's now Kazakhstan. So they were going to have to land on land. That was actually fairly difficult. And I think they decided to sort of this leap to the more dramatic step of sending someone in orbit around the Earth and bring it back again. You know, whereas in the U.S., the plan was to take the sort of progressive step of one achievement after the next and build your way up to it rather than jumping ahead.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA or just send us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. We're back with the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're looking back at the early history of NASA's manned spaceflight program with NASA chief historian Bill Berry. Bill, the first American in space was Alan Shepard. And looking back, it seems that once he returned from his successful suborbital flight in 1961, the entire focus of the Mercury program and then NASA's space program in general seemed to change with President John F. Kennedy's challenge.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
When the Mercury program first started, it had one focus. After the president's challenge, Mercury then became one of the stepping stones to the moon.
Yeah, as we discussed, the Eisenhower administration's plans for Mercury were pretty limited. It wasn't clear that there was going to be a follow-on program, actually, after Mercury. You know, many people were planning for one. And in fact, NASA was planning for what became known as Apollo, back about the same time they were starting to plan the Mercury program. And Apollo at that point was sort of what we do after Mercury. There wasn't a definite real plan for where it would go, but everybody thought going to the moon was sort of the next logical step, but they were thinking it would be in the 80s, you mm-hmm. know, late 70s or 80s, that we'd get that far. There weren't any immediate plans to rush out there on the NASA side. On the political side, it was not clear that there was support to do a lot of other things. President Kennedy comes into office in January 1961 and had campaigned on the fact that the United States was behind the Soviet Union in space and missiles and the military race and all those things. And then immediately there's the embarrassment of the Bay of Pigs situation, and then Gagarin flies and we can't even get, you know, a guy on a suborbital flight. And so he was desperate to change the discussion. And Kennedy, if nothing else, was brilliant at moving the goalposts, because what had been happening, you know, for the last several years before that was the United States would announce we're going to launch a satellite. The Soviets would do it first. We'd announce we're going to put a monkey in space. They put a dog in space. You know, there's a sort of continual thing of where we're being one-upped by the Soviets all the time. And Kennedy saw that, you know, there was no real likelihood that we were going to be able to change that scenario anytime soon, because the Soviets had a much more powerful rocket than we had, and they had a very clever engineering team who were reading the Western press and knew what we were doing and could say, well, we could beat them at this, so let's go do that, right. Which they did brilliantly. They were amazing. And for the U.S., we didn't have any information about really what they were doing over there, so we didn't have any clue on what's going on. So Kennedy sees this problem and it says, you know what? Let's just move the goalpost. You know, it's not going to be about, you know, whether it's the first, you know, communication satellite or the first weather satellite or the first human to do this or the first woman to do, right? The goal is going to be landing on the moon.
In other words, shoot for the moon.
Yeah, exactly. So he goes, you know, that way, you know, if the Soviets do something before we do it, well, so what? The goal is not that particular challenge. The goal is to get to the moon in 10 years. And so he sets that goal with the United States having all of like 15 minutes of experience in space and all suborbital. But he does that. And so NASA, you know, jumps on that and starts expanding rapidly. Congress appropriates lots of extra money. Their program set up to build new rockets. And the program accelerates very dramatically. Interestingly enough, on the Soviet side, they didn't believe that we could do it, right? And to some extent, they were believing their own propaganda that they were ahead, I think. So they didn't actually take the space race seriously. And it wasn't really a race for the first few years. It wasn't until the summer of 1964 that Khrushchev, then the leader of the Soviet Union, realized that the Gemini program was going to be flying soon and that the U.S. actually had a capability that the Soviets couldn't compete with what they had. And then suddenly, that's when the race really began, was in 1964.
When you think of the Mercury flight program, of course, you think of Alan Shepard, but you mostly think about John Glenn, late astronaut, late senator, who passed away in December. Tell us about his flight and why was it important?
Well, of course, by this time, the Soviets had flown twice. Right? They had flown Yuri Gagarin in early 1961, and in August of 61, they sent up Gheremtsev. And he was up for a whole day, right? So lots of accomplishments there. We had launched Shepard in the spring, in May, and then Gus Grissom in the summer. And, of course, Gus Grissom's capsule wound up sinking.
Liberty Bell 7.
Yeah, so that was kind of an embarrassment. And there were lots of problems. In order to get Glenn into orbit, you needed a bigger booster to get him there than the Redstone that was used for the first two suborbital flights. So they were going to use the Atlas rocket. Well, the Atlas rocket was not known to be highly reliable, and there were some issues with that, so they were very concerned about that. And there were a number of problems with the Atlas booster and with the capsule, and Glenn's flight was originally scheduled for the fall of 61, and it slipped and slipped and slipped, and then the weather was bad and all these other things. So by the time Glenn finally launches, this big buildup, and of course, you know, Glenn was a very photogenic and popular guy, mm-hmm. the kind of all-American boy, and the only Marine, actually, of the Mercury 7, too, an interesting aspect of his character. And, you know, it was going to be our chance to prove that we could do at least what the Soviets could do, to launch a person into orbit. And so it became a focus of lots and lots of media attention. And it got the attention of everybody. Got my attention. I was 4 years old, actually, at the time.
Oh, I remember.
I remember sitting in front of our little tiny TV. Actually, it's the first thing I remember in my life.
Right.
Is sitting in front of our little black and white TV and worrying about whether John Glenn would return safely from orbit.
The number one movie in the U.S. is called Hidden Figures. And the movie is about three brilliant African-American women at NASA, Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson. Tell us about these ladies and what they did for the early manned space program, and especially the relationship that one had with John Glenn and his flight of Friendship 7.
Sure. Well, at the time, back in the early 60s, when you talked about a computer, you were talking about a person, and almost always a woman, because it was sort of woman's work. It was not engineering work. And human computers at NASA actually traced their origin back to 1935, when the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the NACA, the engineers at the NACA in the mid-30s were getting very, very busy. The NACA was expanding, and it was making a huge impact on aeronautics research around the world, frankly. The engineers were spending a lot of time doing calculations, and they got tired of doing that, and they said, you know, we could, our time's better spent setting up experiments and analyzing things rather than, you know, doing math work. So the leaders of the NACA said, well, let's hire some people to compute for us, and they took a look around, and other fields that used women for computers before, particularly astronomy, for example, that started back in the 19th century, using women to do the drudgery of,
calculating.
So they hired the first five women. It was sort of an experiment. And people weren't too sure about it. There was some opposition to hiring these women to do this, not necessarily because they're women. Actually, it was mainly about the cost of the calculating machines they were going to be using, because they had these mechanical calculators, and they were pretty expensive at the time. Well, within 6 months of hiring those first five women computers, people were so happy with the results they were getting. The women were more reliable. They didn't complain so much about doing things, and they were less expensive because you didn't have to pay them an engineer's salary. You could pay them a computer salary, which was less. So human computing program expanded during the 30s. And then in the 40s, during the war, manpower was even shorter. And President Roosevelt in 1941 issued an executive order saying that we should hire more African-Americans to work in the war effort. A year and a half later, in 1943, the NACA said, well, you know, we're really desperate for more computers. And there are these black women with math degrees. So they hired the first, again, five African-American women to work as computers. And again, they did such a great job, because most of them came from a fairly small community of math teachers in the black school systems in America. They sort of knew each other, and they knew who the bright ones were. And so that this networking had happened, and it brought in lots of very bright people. One of those people, of course, was Dorothy Vaughan, who wasn't in the first five, but she was hired later in 1943 to come work for the NACA as a computer. And the African-American computing, it was fairly small, you know, about 20 women at any given time. But they did really good work, because unlike some of their women computers who worked in the East computing unit, which was all white, the women in the West computing unit all had math degrees, and they were sort of self-selected as the cream of the crop of brilliant women. And so a lot of those women had incredible capabilities and made huge contributions and were really good at their job. So you wind up with Dorothy Vaughan being hired. Mary Jackson was sort of the next one to be hired. She eventually becomes an engineer. And, of course, Katherine Johnson gets hired in 1952. And she was brilliant. She went in the computing pool for about 2 weeks. When people realized how incredibly talented she was and how interested she was in their work, she quickly got grabbed by the Flight Research Division and was moved out of the computing pool to work as a computer embedded in the Flight Research Division. There were a few people who did that sort of thing in some of the research divisions. But Katherine was incredible. She was a force of nature in terms of her mathematical ability and her interest in things, and she just really loved the work, and she fit in really well there. Of course, the Flight Research Division becomes the people who wind up doing a lot of the flight research for space stuff, and she immediately got pulled into that as the 50s rolled on, and as NACA becomes NASA in 1958, she winds up involved in that. And of course, for those who've seen the movie, spoiler alert for those who haven't, Katherine Johnson is a critical factor in Glenn's flight, because for space flights, you really need electronic computers. Things happen so fast in space that you need to be able to calculate my reentry parameters. If something changes, if you're not where you think you're going to be, you have to be able to adjust those things quickly, and you don't have time for a human computer on the ground to calculate those things. So you really needed electronic computers. And electronic computers were kind of finally getting to the point where they were small enough that you could do those sorts of things and fast enough. But they had to be programmed by people, and they were very complicated and did sometimes do strange things that people didn't quite understand. Usually the problem with the programming, but you didn't know that. And so there were still questions. Now, Glenn's flight's critically dependent on computing calculations from electronic computers, but they're concerned about the software. And so at some point before the flight, in the movie it's dramatized about it being kind of at the last minute, but in reality, Katherine Johnson was asked by Glenn, as the management team was discussing things, they're wondering about how are we going to confirm that the computer will give us the right data. And Glenn said, well, have the girl check the numbers, and if she's good with it, I'm good. Right? And by the girl, he meant Katherine Johnson. It sounds kind of derogatory now, but in those days, you know, women who worked in those fields were generally referred to as girls, even by themselves. So he said, you know, have the girl check the numbers. Everybody knew he meant Katherine Johnson, because she was the girl who did those sorts of things. And she sat down for about 2 days and did all the calculations the computer had programmed in it to make sure that the data that the computer produced was the same data that she would come up with, and it came down completely accurate. She proved, in fact, that the programming of the computer was fine, and everybody was happy with that, and Glenn said, I'm good to go, and launched into space and became the first American to orbit the Earth.
Thank you so much for coming in today and talking about the early manned space program for NASA.
Rick, it's been my pleasure.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.